Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's got to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you of the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of our good friend, Bob Chapman, as we talk about what's happening to the stock markets, to the financial markets throughout the world. But what you must understand is that there's an organized, orchestrated, coordinated effort to destroy the economy of our country. And people say, oh, well, who in their right mind would want to do that? And I would say we're dealing with people who are not in their right mind, who have embraced something called Agenda 21. That is their plan. You can read it. It's up on the internet. It consists, of course, the Agenda 21, the United Nations plan, the Earth Charter, and, of course, the Global Biodiversity Report, and perhaps the writings there on the Georgia Guidestones put up by the Secret Society, that, of course, was telling the world what the future holds. These people look at the world differently than you and I do, and until you understand that, none of this makes sense. Now they're telling us, oh, my goodness, you know, back in Washington, D.C., the one thing everybody's talking about is jobs. And everybody says we need more jobs, waiting for the jobs to come back, working to bring the jobs back. Ladies and gentlemen, they're not going to bring the jobs back. They were intentionally sent overseas. We developed a corporate tax structure that punishes people and companies that keep their jobs in America and rewards them for moving overseas. And, of course, why is it, do you think, if you call AT&T or PG&E or the major corporations, and, the first thing you get is this operator who says, do you want your message in English or in Spanish? What's that all about? Well, it's because our people who run this country want a multicultural, multilingual society. You go to some places in Michigan, they say, do you want your message in English or in Spanish or in Arabic? Because they brought in so many Muslims from other countries. Let's go to our good friend Bob Chapman. Hi, Bob. How are we doing? Bob Chapman, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right, fine. Well, we're simply talking about the fact that everybody's trying to convince the American people that it's just a matter of time before the jobs come home, that the people in Washington, D.C., President Obama is trying to get jobs. He knows very well that the structure of our taxes, our corporate tax structure, is designed to drive people offshore. He keeps talking about wanting to bring down the price of gasoline. He does everything he can to keep the price of gasoline going up by shutting down the pipeline from that would have brought in oil to America from the from the Alberta oil sands up there, tar sands. And people find it so difficult to believe politicians will say one thing, but they have a different agenda. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think they're being paid off to make sure that the oil goes to China. I think it's as simple as that.
Right. And I think it's so difficult for the average American to realize that we have people in key positions in government who have no loyalty to the United States. And they're not simply in the Democratic Party. The Republicans would like to believe that. The leaders of the Republican Party are in on it as well, as are some of the wealthiest people in America today. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll welcome your calls at 1-888-464-8295. Well, Bob, you go right ahead.
Well, they talk about recovery in the economy, and you mentioned it earlier in reference to the jobs that are never coming back. That's 12 million of them. Of course, the government even lies about that. The comment is we lost 9 million jobs because of a recession. Now, anybody that would believe that has to be ignorant when you see what's going on. And it's not hard to observe. It's right there in front of you. So the only way they're going to get jobs back is to either create whole new industries in the United States that probably will work for slave labor income, and put them together that way. Otherwise, they're going to have to put tariffs on everything and level the playing field.
And that, of course, will be to lower our wage level here and raise the wage level throughout the rest of the world. And we're actively bringing people in to the United States under one or another form of visa. And they've certainly something within the last 6 or 7 years. They've taken 8 million jobs and given them to foreigners who come in legally with a green card to work here. And many times they've even required the American employee to train his replacement, and then he's let go, and then is out there looking for a job, and there aren't any jobs because these people are brought in from overseas, under the guise, well, no one will take this job. That's not true at all. There's an American there. He wants the job. Oh, but of course, they can bring this fellow in cheaply, and this is actually being encouraged by the people working behind the scenes who have a different agenda, and that is to lower living standards here and raise living standards throughout the world. And until people understand that, so little of what's going on makes sense. Go right ahead, Bob.
Well, it's the deception and the propaganda. I mean, even the labor unions are not defending their workers. I got a letter today. A man with Ford for 29 years, and for 27 of them, or 26, he was union representative or something like that. But it was an important position. And he'd been reading the forecaster, and he decided that what they were doing was all wrong. And
I want you to hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here with Bob Chapman. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Bob was just saying he got a letter just recently from some fellow who was employed at Ford. He was a labor representative and certainly had worked for Ford. He was also an executive in the union. And he'd been following what was going on. He suddenly realized that labor unions were actively betraying the workers. Well, I saw that in organized medicine. The leaders of organized medicine were betraying the doctors and the patients. But the leaders of organized unions are misleading and betraying their members, the members of the union. Go ahead, Bob.
Well, so what happened was they had an election, and he was not reelected after 26 or 7 years. And right after that, this new younger representative was negotiating, and they shut down a complex of Ford plants in one place, and they lost something like 16,000 jobs. And, you know, people just don't get it. You don't expect labor workers who have usually limited education, you know, high school, to get into these things. But there are others who understand. And, you know, I think the public just doesn't care as long as my ox doesn't get gored.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, as long as things are good and the unions are getting more and more and more for you and bigger benefits and higher pensions and more health care, and then comes the day of reckoning when you suddenly find your unions on the other side and they are intent upon taking away your pensions and taking away your health care. But by this time, the union representatives have the power. And when you look at the membership list of the Trilateral Commission, there are only about 80 members in North America, the North American chapter, you find the leaders of organized labor. members of the Trilateral Commission working right along with the industrialists and the bankers who control industry. And it's all a scam, ladies and gentlemen. And the average union maker member has no idea what's going on. Well, Bob, certainly, what is happening to American industry? We're told things are really getting better. It's only a matter of time before things improve. But that industry is, and manufacturing are picking up in the United States. Is that really true?
Well, I think it is in a minor way. Congress just passed a highways bill, I guess you'd call it, the other day. And we're talking about $100 billion to fix up roads and bridges and so on, and whatever else they threw in there. And that's the kind of thing that they've been depending upon, you know, forced money going into the economy. And, of course, QE1, 2, and now Operation Twist, and Europe get the same thing going on. And these amounts of money don't make permanent jobs. They come, and after they're fixed and used and the jobs are in place, the job is over, and then they have to go on to something else. This is the same concept that what we experienced during 1934 to 1939. It just didn't work. So they had a war. The main way of creating jobs is through new businesses, small businesses, which new ones usually are, and medium-sized businesses. They create more than 70% of all the jobs. And where do they get their money through? From the banks. And the banks aren't lending the way they should be. And until they do, nothing's going to happen.
Well, now, why,
on a long-term basis.
Why aren't the banks lending? Certainly the banks can borrow money, you know, at a 0.25% interest, something ridiculous like that. Why aren't the banks lending when they can borrow so cheaply and it's readily available?
Well, they're afraid the thing might turn the other way, and they get stuck with a lot of bad loans. They also are part of the Federal Reserve System to a great part, and that Federal Reserve System doesn't want inflation. And so how do you stop inflation when you're creating so much money in credit? Jobs, new jobs, create inflation. And that's why they're not tending to that part of the recovery. They're just letting it lie fallow. I mean, the long-term unemployment is 22%+. It's been that way for, I don't know, a year and a half. It's not changing. They don't talk about the birth-death ratio or the U6. And, you know, U3 right now is 8.83%. It's my guess they're going to try to get it down to 7.5% by the election. So Mr. Obama can say, look what I did, all this genius of myself. And I saved you. And that's what he's going to do. You know, turn around and go right back up again.
Yeah, well, I think they're going to manipulate everything, you know, prior to the election. They'll probably bring the price of oil and gas down just before the election, just so the American people will be fat, dumb, and happy as they're led into the slaughterhouse. But after the election, why, and that's in November, why, certainly I think that terrible, terrible things are going to happen to our economy, because there's no way you can indefinitely produce artificial prosperity by simply creating money out of nothing. And for every dollar that our government spends, they have to borrow 43 cents. You can't do that indefinitely. They're doing it now, but each time you borrow more money or create more money, of course, things get better temporarily, and then they get worse, but they get worse quicker. And pretty soon you've got to increase the tempo of creating that new money and putting into the economy. We have the ability to create money out of nothing to the Federal Reserve System, and then to get it sequestered in the banks and rather than being lent out. But once they start lending out, well, we're in for real problems. My telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, because if the economy really began to expand, we would have rapid inflation today. Would you agree with that, Bob?
Absolutely. And that's why they don't want to expand it. And nobody talks about it. Analysts, economists, they don't get it. And it's so fundamental.
When you increase the amount of money in the circulation or available, why, of course, you increase prices. I mean, certainly, inflation does not cause rising prices. It's certainly increasing the amount of money in circulation creates rising prices and inflation. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. They're trying to give us the idea that the problems are solved over in France. There's nothing to worry about. The problems are solved there in Greece. Problems are solved in Portugal. Problems are certainly solved in Spain and Italy. And yet, in Greece today, a young man, 18 to 25, I think, the unemployment rate is about 48%. In Spain, in men 18 to 25, why the unemployment rate is over 50%. I mean, certainly this is going to break down the very structure of society over there, and the people are furious, aren't they?
Yes, they are, and they really don't know what to do. And in France, they're going to go back and do the same thing they did before, trade one socialist for another. And Holland will get the country in really, really bad trouble. And they think things are going to go on forever because the bankers have told them, don't worry about it. We're going to take care of it. If we have to, we'll print some more money. And we'll sell some more bonds like we see in England do right now. They're thinking for only the third time since 1694. At the formation of the Bank of England, they're going to sell 100-year bonds. I mean, who is going to buy those? I mean, it'd have to be the stupidest people in the entire world. I mean, there's no way you can make money on them. And, but they're going to do it anyway. What are they going to do? Probably sell them to the banks. And the banks will create the money out of thin air. And nobody cares. As long as the financial system continues to function, that is the seat and key to the power of the people who run things. And that is the people who create all these problems in the first place so they can get more control over us, and that's going to continue, and it's not going to get better, and that's what's going to force Americans to take dramatic reaction and efforts. I mean, people out there know something terrible, bad's going on. Most of them just close their eyes and hope it goes away.
Well, it's not going to go away. Apparently, most of our major banks, or many of our major banks, are really totally economically unsound. Martin Weiss puts out a report. I just got it today. And he's talking about Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Citicorp. I mean, he rates them from A to F, and most of them are down to D or D minus. Our telephone number is 1-888-824-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We've got Jack on the line from Michigan. Jack, do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I do, Dr. Stan. I need to have a commanding knowledge of the differences between collateralized debt obligations, credit default swaps, and derivatives. I'm going to be campaigning door-to-door. Time is perfect to explain to people how they've been defrauded and extorted by the Federal Reserve, Wall Street, Bankster Gangsters. I want to refer them to Bob's website and yours, but I got to be able to explain.
What is it? It's a credit default swap, or CDS, and a collateralized debt obligation and a derivative. So what's the difference between a credit default swap, a collateralized debt obligation, and a derivative?
Well, the first two are derivatives. A collateralized debt obligation is a form of insurance policy, and that policy is taken out and sold to you, let's say J.P. Morgan Chase, and it, depending upon the amount of money involved, insures debt and sovereign debt. Now, just recently, in Greece, there were banks in Europe that insured that debt through J.P. Morgan and others, and they were told that's not a total default, it's only partial. Instead of paying you $150 billion, we're only going to pay you $3 billion. Well, the real figure is it's going to be about $30, $35 billion, but they haven't told anybody yet. But that insurance policy is called a credit default swap. It's uncollateralized, nothing behind it, just a good word of J.P. Morgan. And there are 1.5 quadrillion CDS has been sold to investors throughout the world. That's an awful lot. The credit default swap is what that is. A collateralized debt obligation is almost the same thing. It's slightly different, and you can get the differences by just going to Google and put in CDS, derivatives, etc., and it's all there for you.
And I think, Jack, the collateralized debt obligation is a debt obligation that are mortgages that they've bundled together, and of course that becomes a debt obligation to collateralize. In other words, they're packed up by the mortgages. That is different than the CDS, credit default swap, or the derivatives, both of which are insurance policies, so that if you purchase a bond, or you purchase something that you're supposed to be repaid on, it's an insurance policy, you get your money. The only problem is, of course, that there is no money behind the CDS or derivatives. They're very loosely regulated, which they should never have been loosely regulated. And what, of course, they are supposed to pay off on the CDS or the derivatives, they don't have the money, and that's what's going to bring down the whole banking system. Hang on, we'll be back in a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We've just had Jack calling from Michigan, asking the difference between a collateralized debt obligation, a derivative, and a CDS, and Bob did explain that. Anything else, Jack, before we let you go?
Well, okay. I heard recently that gold and silver mining stocks might not be a good investment.
All right, fine. Let's get Bob to comment on that. And Jack has heard people are saying, well, really gold and silver aren't a good investment, but then what would you invest in? How would you answer that, Bob?
Well, I recommend people buy gold and silver coins and shares. And I don't know of any reason not to buy shares.
And I think, Jack, the major problem is, Jack, there is no other investment. You may not make a lot of money, but you won't lose your money. If you go into the stock market, you go into bonds, and anything mediated in dollars can be destroyed by inflation. Inflation's underway. Not a matter of if, but when. They've decided to destroy the value of our currency through inflation. And so anybody who tells you that gold and silver are poor investment is not looking after your best interests. Thanks very much for calling. And let's go to John, calling us from Albany, New York. John, do you have a question or comment for Bob?
Yes. Good evening, Dr. Stan. Good evening, Mr. Chapman. My question is regarding China and the oil situation. It seems to me there's oil almost everywhere in the world these days, but it looks to me like China does mostly importing oil. And I was curious if you're aware of if China has oil reserves. And if they do, why don't they exploit their own? Because I heard that the story I heard was they're being manipulated to disable their economy with the price of oil.
Well, I don't know about their economy being manipulated to collapse, but China does have oil, and they probably have oil in the South China Sea, and they're going to have to come to an agreement with the other parties. I think it might be South Korea.
No, it's Vietnam over there.
Vietnam.
Right.
And once they come to an agreement, they'll start drilling out there. But in the meantime, their demand for oil and petroleum products is very high. So they're importing oil from all over the world. And that's natural. They don't know that there's any easy oil to be found in China. And that's why they do what they do.
I see. Oh, thanks very much.
Okay, let's go to Sam, who's calling from Cincinnati. And, of course, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question for Bob Chapman on what's going on, but it is our contention that what is going on economically is not accidental. There really is a plan for the wretching transformation of our society. That's the phrase that's used by people who support Agenda 21. The people who really control our government do support Agenda 21, the secret agenda for the 21st century. It's not secret. You can get it from the UN. You can get it on the Internet. But it's kept secret from the American people by the people who control the media. It calls for a wretching transformation of society. And that's what we're in the process of seeing today. But they do not want the American people to know that they are intentionally destroying our economy and destroying the value of our currency so that they can lower our living standards and raise living standards throughout the world. Sam in Cincinnati, you have a question for Bob.
Yes, sir. Good evening, man. Bob, how do you see 401k retirement plans 5 to 10 years from now?
I don't think they'll exist. You know, there's 4 or 5 pieces of legislation in the House and the Senate. I think they're kind of leaning toward a voluntary plan at first. And that voluntary plan would allow people to take their 401ks and their IRAs in retirement and hand them to the government, who in turn would give them a guaranteed annuity from the government. And I think if they pass that, it'll only take a year or two, and they'll find a way to make it compulsory. And I think that's the direction. So I discourage people from taking out IRAs and 401ks. You're not escaping anything.
You
might be facing that as well.
Oh. So what would you do? Would you cash it out or what?
You can get out of your IRA. 401ks all depends on who's running the 401k.
Mm-hmm. What would you invest it in?
Well, I like gold and silver shares primarily. You can't go into debt instruments. There's no yield. And if you want to gamble in the stock market, you can do that.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. right ahead.
And so I think the government is going to go after that. It's about $6 trillion, and they'll need that to keep the economy going. So I think it's a prized place for them to go. So I would open up personal accounts just and pay your taxes and so on and so forth. And I wouldn't fool around with them.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, fine. That was Sam calling from Cincinnati. Once again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Here in the Central Coast of California, if you have a question or comment, but certainly the world economy is having very, very real problems. Well, Bob, what do you foresee for Europe? Do you think that, of course, they're going to be able to bring things under control? Do you think that Greece is eventually going to default, along with the other so-called pig nations, Portugal, Sydney, Ireland, Greece, and Spain?
Well,
Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain, doesn't maybe put two eyes in there.
Well, first of all, I think before this year is over, that Greece will default. Excellent chance. And that'll be followed by Ireland and Portugal. And then the rest of Europe, the solvent, is going to have to bail Italy and Spain out for about $4 trillion. I mean, where are they going to get the money? I mean, they're already suffering. Germany has subsidized over the last 8 years $300 billion a year to those recalcitrant economies. And there's no end in sight. And then you go over and look. I just wrote an article about Holland. Instead of having a 2.5% growth rate, they get 1 to 1.5%. Why? Because they're subsidizing these countries that just don't stop getting themselves in trouble. And I'm sure sooner or later they'll get to Finland. France is certainly in not good condition, especially their banks. Probably the only thing they got going for them is their gold. And, you know, they're going to put in these austerity measures.
Hold that thought, Bob. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Bob Chapman. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, our guest this evening, Bob Chapman from the International Forecaster. And he's simply saying that it's only a matter of time before all of the southern European countries default. There isn't enough money to actually to bail them out, and the people of those countries don't want to have to go to work. They can retire at 55, you know, and a good pension and certainly good health care. They have all sorts of safety nets. The people there do not want to work, whereas, of course, the people in Northern Europe are industrious people, the Germans hardworking. But, of course, they're having to subsidize the people in Southern Europe, the so-called pig nations. And because basically they all are bound together in the European Union, and certainly they're all bound together in the European currency. The southern European countries cannot simply go out and print money. This is how we're getting by. We're living high on the hog because our government's able to print money and has to. Then they can borrow certainly, so that 43 cents out of every cent we, every dollar that's spent today is borrowed money. But sooner or later, that borrowed money has to be replaced. Well, let's go right ahead. We have Robert calling from Cincinnati, so let's see what Robert has to say. Go ahead, Robert. Uh-oh, we lost Robert. Well, maybe Robert will call back in again. I apologize for that. That was my mistake. I pushed the wrong button. Bob, while we're waiting for Robert to call, would you mind going ahead and put out your information so people could learn how to go about certainly obtaining the Forecaster and subscribing to the Forecaster?
Well, the International Forecaster is about business, finance, economic, social, and political issues all over the world, published on Wednesdays and Saturdays, usually runs 35 to 40 pages each time, We have a hard copy that goes out twice a month for those who are not on the Internet. And everything that you need to know each week is in that publication. If you'd like to get a free introductory copy, you can go to theinternationalforecaster.com. theinternationalforecaster.com. And you can also go to intforecaster.com, intforecaster.com. For those of you who'd like to ask a question, get a copy of the publication, or get a copy of our latest report on gold and silver shares, you can email us. And that address is Bob, B-O-B, at intforecaster.com, intforecaster.com. And for those of you who'd like to call toll-free, that number is 800-375-4188, 800-375-4188.
All right, we had Robert who had calling us from Cincinnati, and I hit the wrong button and cut him off. He'd like to call back, but I'll make it a point to get him on in just a moment here. Right now we have Rich calling from Aromas. Rich, do you have a question for our guest?
Hi, guys. How are you doing?
Doing fine. Do you have a question for Bob?
Yes, I do. I went and picked up my taxes the last time I talked to you, and boy, they got me with a pretty good penalty on that, pulling money out of my retirement fund, which I invested, as you guys recommended, and broke about even. But this gal is about 25 years old, and she said she's doing the same thing. And I just curious, I said, well, why did you do it? She goes, because I don't trust, she's a CPA, and she sees, here she goes, there's a lot of things that are going on from the IRS that you don't know, and I don't know if I'm even going to be in business next year because it's getting so shady. And she goes, I pulled mine out, and I should be getting my check, and I don't care if I have to pay the penalties. But she said she wanted to put it in silver, and I said, oh, really? I said, well, I have the right guy. So, Bob, do you sell actual silver coins?
No. Okay. No, I usually refer people to that 800 number, which is Melody Cederstrom.
Okay.
And she takes care of anything in the coin, bullion area, and I have three brokers that I use that I recommend to buy stocks through because I've known them for many years, and they're all very good, and they're honest, et cetera.
All right. I told them I'd give them my forecaster, and then they could call, well, I guess they could call Melody. But it's, she wouldn't get into it. But do you know anything that's going on with the IRS? I think they're going to do what you just said, where they're going to say, hey, we'll give you a guaranteed 7%. You don't have to worry about it. And trust us, because she's been kind of spooky on what the IRS is up to. She says they're after all the little businesses. They're auditing a lot of the little businesses and going after the little, she said, the little people, the little guys. For under $10,000, they're acting like a little watchdog. So do you know anything else that might be going on?
Well, I think they avoid going after the high number of people because they'll do what I did when I was making millions. They'll hire the best legal talent in the country, and they'll win their case. Their attorney fees might range anywhere from $50,000 to $500,000. But it beats paying what they want from you. Yeah, all it is extortion.
That's exactly about what she said. You might have the information on how many people are starting to pull money out of their retirement plans. Do you have any stats on that?
Yeah, about 28%.
28% of the people are starting to pull their money out.
Yeah, Rich, I'm going to have to let you go, but excellent questions, and thank you so very much. Of course, Rich's point that certainly the IRS is doing all sorts of things that are irritating. But remember, it was back in the 60s, there were a couple of socialists who wrote an article, and they said, look, if we want to destroy capitalism, what we want to do is at least so antagonize the American people using the existing laws that they will turn against their form of government. And, of course, that's exactly what's happening now, almost 50 years later. I think the article was written about 63 or 64, and I've forgotten the two people who wrote it, but basically they said, you destroy capitalism by simply playing the game and using all of the government programs to the excess, to the point where people eventually come to hate their government. And that's exactly what they are doing today. The socialists working at the government are doing everything they can to antagonize the people. But unfortunately, of course, the alternative is going to be much worse. What we need to do is get back to our Constitution and limit the power of government. Well, let's go to Robert, who's calling us from Cincinnati with a question for Bob. Again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Robert in Cincinnati, do you have a question for Bob?
Yes, Bob. I wonder if you could explain in a little more detail why it is that prices of things would necessarily have to rise if the banks start lending out funds, like for people to start businesses. I seem to recall, I think it was back in the 70s, early 70s, when Nixon was in office, he did some kind of price and wage control, as I recall. And would something like that help if the banks could lend out the money but prevent the inflation?
Price controls have never worked. All they do is suppress demand. And what he did was a disaster. And, of course, just before that, on August 15, 1971, he went off the gold standard because, no one remembered. People wanted to take delivery of gold for dollars, namely France, among others. And wage and price controls don't work. Because the minute you take them off, they're just going to revert to their normal level.
So what causes that to happen? Why do they necessarily have to rise? Why do prices?
Because people want to make up for what they've been losing under government decree or edict.
In other words, you can't sell at a loss indefinitely. People have to make a profit, and if you put on price controls, people simply either quit selling or suddenly there's much of a decrease in the incentive to sell. I mean, why should I go into business and sell things and lose money on them? And that's what price controls do. Basically, there was a Roman Empire named emperor named Diocletian, and he lived about 300 A.D. And they had inflation back in those days. And he imposed wage and price controls, and it was a capital offense to actually sell anything for a higher price. And the whole system collapsed under Diocletian. Part of history that we never talk about today. There's nothing new under the sun, Robert. They've tried it repeatedly through the past. Wage and price controls don't work. The only thing that really works is a free enterprise system. They'll work for a time, but eventually the whole thing collapses. Anything else, Robert?
Well, just following that same thought, I know I heard your comment just a moment ago about the socialists. I believe it was Karl Marx who had said that capitalism contains within it the seeds of its own destruction. And does that refer to these prices rising so that wealth tends to move to just a very small number of people while the remaining people become poor? Is that the dynamic he was referring to?
Bob, would you like to comment on that?
Yes, but there were many others as well. Karl Marx was not a dumb man. He was very smart.
Yeah.
And, essentially what he and many others like him said, there isn't a system that works. So,
this is capitalism. This has nothing to do with the free enterprise system. Capitalism and free enterprise are not the same. I mean, capitalism is a monopoly system. A free enterprise is a free system, a free economic system. And basically the term capitalism was originated by Karl Marx, who was defining the enemy that he wanted to oppose. Go right ahead.
That's Karl Marx, yes. Okay, so the idea is not so much to have capitalism work as it is to have free market work. What would have to happen for that to occur? Oh, are you still there?
Yes, Bob. What would have to happen for a free market to be instituted in America?
Rather than capitalism.
I think we would have a currency that was backed by gold, or even perhaps other commodities. But gold is the simplest and has been for centuries. And you couldn't create more money and credit willy-nilly like the Federal Reserve now does.
Right.
And if you had that sort of situation, people would use free enterprise to start businesses. Assumably, they would have accumulated gold or dollars, and they would use that to expand.
Yes.
Which is a phenomenal opportunity.
Okay.
And that's really what free enterprise is all about.
Okay. So really the only candidate so far for president that even approaches that idea is Mr. Paul, Ron Paul, I guess.
Yeah,
you're
true.
Absolutely right. And basically, you have to limit the bureaucracy. You have to limit the government regulations. Yes, you may need some regulations, but the fewer regulations you have, the better it will be. In a free society, you limit the power of government. Liberty and limited government is synonymous. Tyranny and total government is synonymous. We're moving towards total government control of regulation of everything because there really are people who do not believe in freedom, and they want to destroy this nation and suddenly bring about this one-world dictatorship under a ruling oligarchy, and they're well on their way to accomplishing it. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Robert, do you have anything else to ask?
No, thank you very much for your ideas and wisdom in this.
Well,
thank you very much.
It's pretty late back there in Cincinnati where you are. We appreciate you sitting up to listen to our program. Do you listen regularly?
I listen as often as I can. That's maybe a couple of nights per week. So as often as I can.
God bless. Thanks. It's good to have you as one of our regular listeners.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, Chris, if you're out there and you have a question for Bob, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And certainly, we are entering into a very, very difficult period. And once the government has decided to just try to solve the problems through inflation, or maybe knowingly, intentionally destroying the economy through inflation, it's only a matter of time. Each time, of course, you put out more money, why, of course, you solve the problem temporarily. But, of course, the periods where things are looking up get shorter and shorter and shorter, and you have to be putting out more money ever so much more frequently. Would you agree with that, Bob?
Absolutely. And that's how we got in this mess, because the bankers wanted it that way, so they can eventually take everything away from us and put in place their world government. That's what it's all about.
And until people really understand that that is mainly what this is about, nobody's going to tell you that this is all about creating a world government. But they want to convince you that the bankers are interested in making money, and I'm sure they're not against making money. But that is not the major motivation behind what's going on today. Because behind everything that's going on are powerful, powerful spiritual forces. So let's go to Bill, who's calling from the Tri-Cities area up in Washington. Hi, Bill. How are you doing? I have a question for our guest.
Yeah, I'm wondering what he thinks about this March 16th executive order that Obama signed, which pertains to control of all aspects of the economy. The government declares an emergency. If supposedly this is something that has been routinely passed by the government, but it seems there are a lot of people that are concerned that perhaps this could be some instrument of control for the government to appropriate all private property for itself at some unknown time.
Bob, I'm sure you're acquainted with this recent executive order. It's a rewriting of an earlier executive order put off by Bill Clinton, renewed by George Bush, and now signed by Senator Obama, that allows them to ration food and water and hospitalization and restrict travel. And of course, only, of course, an emergency situation. The trouble is the president can declare an emergency anytime he wants to, or they can have a false flag operation. It's a blueprint for dictatorship. What are your thoughts about it?
It's a disaster. It's the end of the Constitution. It's the end of the Bill of Rights, everything that we've ever had. It's over.
Bill, I think you have to understand that basically this has been the law for a long time. Why hasn't Congress been concerned about it before? And this is, it's all unconstitutional and a violation of our rights. If there's an emergency, they should be taken care of by the state and the local government, not by the federal government. Anything else, Bill?
I'm not trying to be an alarmist or anything, but, I understand they've had this on the books for a long time, but that's the whole point, is that they've never really had the authority to have that. They're just saying that they do.
Well, that's a good way of putting it under executive order. I'd like it that way, so it will be. That's what all dictators do. And it's just like the Enabling Act in Germany in 1933. It allowed Hitler to do the same thing, become dictator, and it'll happen with Barack Obama.
Is there a possibility that they might just cycle through the presidents a few more times before they do it, or do you think it's Obama?
No, I really don't know. But I think right after the election, you're going to find that things are going to change for the worse dramatically.
And basically, of course, the thing is, why didn't the Senate and the House of Representatives counter this? Because they can counter it, and they could counter the most recent one. It is because we have the finest politicians money could buy in Washington, D.C., and they are either unwilling or afraid to counter the executive orders put forward by the president, which are flagrantly unconstitutional and dictatorial. Anything else, Bill?
Well, it just basically seems that the United States is now under this G8 UN kind of government. I mean, even the protests, they're saying that you all get a federal felony if you go to the G8 and protest near a government official. And I mean, maybe they've had these kind of repressions before during world economic calamities like in the 30s or whatever. I mean, I've heard they've given people long.
Bill, we've never had anything like this before. We're in real trouble. Help us get the word out. Get those people up in Tri-Cities listening to our programs. Get them to read my book and get them to read the International Forecaster, okay?
Okay.
Good night. God bless.
See you later.
We're just about out of time, Bob. What are your parting thoughts for our listeners?
It's going to be the defining thing that happens over the next several years. And when they're ready to pull martial law in a peaceful environment because there's terrorists running around, some false flag operation, then...
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Bob was just saying that right now, of course, things will be pretty good until the election. After that, he anticipates things will get much worse, and he can see them having a false flag operation or pointing to those wicked terrorists. Ladies and gentlemen, we financed the terrorists. Remember the underwear bomber? Well, of course, if you haven't read Kurt Haskell's testimony at the sentencing hearing, you need to get it. Kurt Haskell was on the plane, and he had followed the case very closely. At the sentence hearing, he actually testified, And what he said was totally suppressed by the New York Times and all of the press in America, because he talked about congressional hearings where a man named Patrick Kennedy had actually gotten up before Congress and admitted the State Department knew that Umar, the underwear bomber, was a terrorist. And the State Department had put Umar, the underwear bombing, onto the plane. Now, of course, elsewhere, why it was determined that the bomb was built not to go off. Why would you put on a bomb that was not designed not to go off? Because they wanted to use it to actually bring in the CT scanners already built, already deployed, waiting for an incident. They created that incident, and that was Umar, the underwear bomber. Read Kurt Haskell's testimony. It's on his website. If you can't get it, you get it from us by calling 1-800-544-8927. Most of the incidents you read about are created. If you read on the internet right tonight, you'll find out that the Afghan government has certainly investigated the recent killing of 16 people, women and children, in two communities over in Afghanistan. They said it was a team of 20 American soldiers. Go up on the internet, you can check it out, and I believe it's true. The Afghan government is saying that this was a planned retaliation on the Afghan people. They're telling us one lone gunman. I don't believe it, and neither do the Afghan people. And this, we have not heard the end of this story. Bob Chapman, we're out of time. Thank you so very much for being with us again. We'll look forward to talking to you next week.
You got it. Bye-bye.
God bless. Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan. There's so much more. You can go to our website, RadioLiberty.com. You can listen to our programs. You can read our newsletters. You can watch our DVDs. And we do hope many of you will decide you're going to help Radio Liberty or maybe even advertise with us if you have a product you'd like to put out. But, ladies and gentlemen, we hope that you'll want to get our new DVD. It's entitled Geoengineering. It's the talk that Rosalind Peterson gave at our last conference. We hope you'll want to get the new DVD. It's called Dangerous Deception. Dangerous Deception. It's an interview I did with Norman Dodd in 1980, where, of course, he tells what the Congressional Committee that he worked for, the Reese Committee, found out that they, when they investigated the Carnegie, Ford, and Rockefeller Foundations. And then, of course, you'll have about an hour dissertation, 45-minute dissertation, as I tell you what I've learned over 50 years and help you understand the significance of what Mr. Norman Dodd was talking about. Because a lot of what he said in 1980, I did not understand at that time. I do understand it now. And I understand what the real goal and motivation is behind so much of what's going on. It's to bring about a world government, and certainly behind that are the powerful spirits of forces that not only want a world government, they want a world, one world monetary system, they want to destroy Christianity, and they want a one world ruler. And then, of course, we hope that many of you will want to get the book, The Secret of the Lord. The Secret of the Lord, written by our good friend Chuck Crismeyer. It tells how they have changed the music and the message of the Christian church. They've infiltrated our religious organizations just exactly as they've infiltrated our conservative organizations, our liberal organizations. They control the media, the educational system, the banks, the major corporations, the military leaders of our country. Our number 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for America. Please pray for Radio Liberty, our provision and our protection. And that I love. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for the survival of Christian civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that will determine what the future will bring. Well, for the next hour, our guest is going to be our good friend William Federer, and we're going to be talking about his views on what's happening politically in our country today. And, of course, you can't understand anything going on politically unless you understand the spiritual forces behind what's going on and the fact that some people are going to utilize these so-called spiritual forces and, you know, the altruism, the love for America and for righteousness and for the family that we all have. But anyway, I'm going to let William give you his views on what's going on. William, you pick up the story there. There we are. William Federer, certainly the author of, I don't know, how many books have you written now, William?
Oh, about 20.
All right. Well, we actually carry a number of them. We certainly value William's opinions, and we, as I say, we do carry many of his book. He puts out something called The American Minute, and certainly he puts that out on a daily basis. Some thought for the day, and you can go to his website and get that information. But you pick up the story. What would you like to talk about tonight?
Well, the president's chief of staff was Rahm Emanuel. He made a statement, never let a good crisis go to waste. But there was another campaign advisor to the president whose name is David Axelrod. And David Axelrod was quoted on NPR in April 2010. And he said, in Chicago politics, we have a tradition where you throw a brick through your own campaign office window and then call a press conference to accuse your opponent. In other words, you tank the economy on purpose and put people out of work, then call a press conference to accuse the rich white corporate Republican elitists. And so we see that what's happening today is actually in what looks like an intentional destroying of the economy and increasing the number of people on welfare, because he needs to have people hurting so that he can blame the rich white corporate Republican elitists and pick your candidate that would best fit that mold.
Well, I think it's so important that the American people understand that everything we hear about is jobs. We have to have jobs. Ladies and gentlemen, there's been an organized, orchestrated, coordinated effort to force our industries out of America. They came up with a corporate structure, a corporate tax structure, whereas if you keep your corporation in the United States, you pay 35% corporate tax. If you move offshore, why, of course, you don't pay any American corporate tax. Where do you think most of our corporations want to go? And this is why so much of our automotive industry is offshore, or certainly our steel industry is offshore, our clothing industry is offshore, most of the drugs you take are manufactured offshore, so much of our electronic equipment, I mean, at the Apple iPhone, all of these things are either manufactured or assembled offshore. And we go right down the line. They've destroyed the lumber industry, the mining industry. They've destroyed the fishing industry, much of the agricultural industry. It's all been done intentionally. So there'll be a shortage of jobs here. And then they can say, look, what we need is a new government program to counter that. And I think you're absolutely right. William, go right ahead.
So I wrote a book. It's called Change to Chains. It's the 6,000-year quest for control. And we look back in history and see some things that are happening today that have been preceded. And one is Stalin. He actually created a famine in the Ukraine to intentionally squelch and put out of, the ones that were threatening his reign.
Hold that thought. William, go right ahead. You were just saying how Stalin had actually created a famine to destroy his opposition, and go right ahead.
And there's a term called agent provocateurs. The reason that there's never been was never a Tea Party movement in the Soviet Union is that whenever they would get one going, they would infiltrate it with an agent provocateur who would actually egg them on to commit some kind of crime so the government would have an excuse to crack down on them. And then there's an interesting story of Sergei Kirov. Around 1935, Stalin needed another crisis to... Stalin said crises are necessary for the government to demand and obtain total submission of all citizens. And so there was an anti-Stalinist movement that was brewing, and Stalin was in a quandary as how to get rid of it, and he had a supporter named Sergei Kirov who was giving speeches praising Stalin, and he was in Leningrad, he was the party boss, and he was becoming a little too popular for Stalin's comfort. So Stalin had an idea. He would murder this supporter of his and blame it on the anti-Stalinists. And he was able to do a purge that killed like a million people. And so when you take away, you know, morality, then anything goes. And the telltale sign is that when the dust settles, power always is reconcentrated. Another interesting thing is the National Defense Authorization Act, which the president has signed, gives the government the ability to stop any person at any time and detain them indefinitely and confiscate their assets and their property and their houses and so forth and under suspicion. And this is very similar to the 1765 writs of assistance, where the British government, the King of England, could detain anybody at any time for any reason, and if they were suspected on being a terrorist. And in other words, we had just finished the French and Indian War, and the British wanted to leave troops on American soil to just in case there was another war, and they wanted Americans to pay for it. They would put these troops up in American homes. They would quarter them in the American homes. And but they would have this ability where they could catch anybody at any time under suspicion and detain them and lock them away indefinitely without a trial, without a warrant. And so it was James Otis who preached, or actually he was an attorney, and he argued against this for 5 hours in the Massachusetts Legislative Assembly there. And in the audience was John Adams. And John Adams heard this and was so inspired that it lit his fuse. And that's when John Adams...
Hold that thought. Hold that thought here. Well, this is Dr. Stan and Sydney. William is talking about how Sydney, Stalin used all sorts of tricks to increase his power. He had a good friend who was... his name was Sergei, and Sergei was becoming increasingly popular with the public. And so basically what he did is he had Sergei killed, and then he blamed it on his opponents and then went out and murdered about a million of Russians who were accused of being part of a revolutionary movement. And this is the sort of technique that tyrants use. Certainly these techniques were used in the 1760s by the King of England. And basically, they just finished these, one of the wars there, French-Indian War, something like that. And he decided he wanted to quarter his British Hessian troops, and they were simply going to have them quartered. People were going to have to take the troops into their homes and keep them there, and they were going to, of course, be able to arrest anyone who spoke out against the power of the King of England. This was in the 1760s. And, of course, very, very similar to legislation that was recently passed called the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, signed into law by President Obama, that certainly allows them to arrest anybody accused of terrorism and then to detain them indefinitely without a trial, without the writ of habeas corpus. Of course, Obama put an appendum on that saying, of course, that would not apply to Americans. But when they tried to actually get legislation through, when this bill was going through Congress, saying it did not apply to American citizens, why the Obama administration blocked that. So the signing statement has no real effect, but of course the fact that the Obama administration opposed an amendment to the NDAA Act that would have restricted the right to arrest and detain people to non-American citizens lets you know what they are really up to. So you go right ahead with him.
So David Axelrod, the president's campaign advisor, said, in Chicago politics, we have a tradition where you throw a brick through your own campaign office window and then call a press conference to accuse your opponent. And so what is his advice to the president's reelection strategy? Well, it could very well be tanking the economy on purpose and putting people out of work on purpose and causing the gas prices to rise on purpose and so that the people are hurting. Then you call a press conference and give a speech and you blame these rich white corporate Republican elitists who are making $22 million a year. And so this is a strategy, and it's very effective, and it's been used, you know, 45 countries felt it this way. And so in the book, the Change the Chains book, I go through history. And, you know, the history is a good indicator. The one saying is past behavior is the best indicator of future performance. So if, and human behavior replicates. And that's why I talk about in the book how the normal form of government in all of recorded human history is what? You know, I got all the records. You know, you can get any world civilization textbook and open it up to chapter one. And it starts about 3,000 or 4,000 B.C., with Egyptian hieroglyphics and Sumerian cuneiform on clay tablets. And 4,000 B.C., 2,000 A.D., it's 6,000 years. And that's really not that long. That's just 60 people living 100 years each back to back. And you're all the way back to the beginning of recorded human history. 60 people back to back, 100 years each. And the typical form of government in all of these 60 centuries is dictatorship, a monarchy. They go by different names, Caesars, Pharaohs, Kaisers, Sultans, Czars, but power inevitably gravitates into the hands of one person. So you drop a bunch of kids on a playground, one of them winds up being the bully hogging the ball. Drop a bunch of people in the woods, one of them winds up being the Indian chief. And you drop a bunch of people in an inner city, winds up being the gang leader. This is the default. So in other words, if you got rid of all government right now, what would happen? Well, you'd have people breaking into houses and stealing, and then people would fight them. And lo and behold, somebody would turn out to be a good fighter. And you'd get behind that person and say, you be our captain. You tell us what to do. And you'd gravitate toward a good king and then the bad king. And you'd resort to monarchy. And so throughout world history, the most common form of government is monarchy, dictatorship. And if you're friends with the dictator, you are more equal. If you're not with the dictator, you are less equal. And if you're an enemy of the dictator, you're dead. It's called treason. So equality is not made in the image of a creator. Equality is how close of an orbit can you get to this really important person, the king. And that's what our founding fathers faced. When you were a loyalist and you were a supporter of the king, well, you'd go before the judge and get more justice. But if you were a loyalist, you know, or a patriot of America, you wouldn't expect the same type of justice. And so they didn't want that. And so that's why they decided to set up our form of government in America, where they made the people the king. In the history of the world, I found three things that kept coming up in the ancient civilizations. One, a fascination with the stars. Two, buildings to observe the stars. And three, somebody that got to climb up the building and claim that they were the divine intermediary between heaven and the people. So the Assyrians and the Babylonians had king priests, and the Egyptian claimed their pharaohs were the son of the god Osiris. And, you know, Alexander the Great, you know, claimed to have a divine calling, and the Chinese emperors claimed to rule because they had a mandate from heaven, and the Indian kings claimed to be semi-divine Maharajas, and the Incan emperors in Peru, they claimed to be delegates of the sun god. And then when Europe got, of course, the Caesars demanded that their image be worshipped and that they be august, which means divine, August Caesar. And then when Europe became Christian, they simply Christianized it and called it the divine right of kings. So God chose me to be the king. Whatever my will is must be God's will because he picked me. But it's this idea that there's this political intermediary between you and God in heaven. And then you look in the book that I wrote on the alternatives, and lo and behold, Israel. You know, the first thought is, well, gee, Moses went to the mountain, and Moses was the intermediary, and he got the law from God. Yes, but there's a big, important difference. The law that Moses came down from the mountain with said the king is equal to the people, and the king has to make a copy of the law and read it every day so he would not think of himself more highly than his brethren. And here's Moses. He strikes the rock, and he doesn't get to go in the promised land. So the law he came down with did not set him up as somebody that had, could get out from under the law. And then Aaron's two sons offer unholy fire before the Lord, and fire comes out and consumes them. And so God's saying, okay, there's no special favorites that get to disobey my law. Everybody is equal and has to obey it. And so the Jewish law is different. And when they, you know, they came out of Egypt, and for 200 years the Jews did not have a king. And there was nobody to buddy up next to. And everybody was equal before this law. And they had maximum individual liberty. Matter of fact, the first recorded instance of private land ownership is in Leviticus, where it says, don't move the ancient boundary marker between properties. This indicated that individuals owned agricultural land, where in Egypt, the Pharaoh owned all the land. In Sumeria and Babylon, the king owned it. They've uncovered these caches of cuneiform, these clay tablets, and piles of them, and lo and behold, it's the king deciding what's going to be grown, and he had a whole class of scribe accountants that kept track of what came in. They were keeping all the records of it, and the king owned it. And so when the Jews came out of Egypt, they didn't have a king. Everybody got to own their own land. You read through the book of, the Pentateuch and then Joshua, and they're drawing all lots for the land, and this goes to this family and this tribe, and they get that lot. It's sort of boring reading through it, but it's making a statement. This is land being given to families.
Samuel, the book of Samuel covers this very well, because basically pointing out that there really certainly was no monarchy. The people were ruled by judges, but they didn't have a king. And of course, what happened then when the king insisted, or when the people insisted on having a king because there was so much corruption in the judges? But anyway, you go ahead with the story.
Yeah, so the people came to Samuel, and they said, we don't like this. We want to be like all the other countries. We want a king. And Samuel said, you're not going to like it, but here's Saul. He's going to take your best land and give it out to his favorites. Wealth redistribution. He's going to take your sons, make them run before his chariots, and daughters, make them be his cooks. In other words, he's going to determine the fate of your kids' lives. And the people said, we don't care. We want them anyway. The dynamics was... they would sin, and God would let some tribe overrun them, and then somebody, they'd cry out, and God would raise up somebody to be a deliverer. And it could be from the lowest tribe, like Gideon, you know, and there was no royal family. But the people were lazy. They said, let's get some permanent guy that's going to take care of this. And so we don't have to, you know, seek the Lord all the time. He'll take care of it. And they gave up their freedom for security, but they ended up with neither. But that was the end of Israel's 200-year experiment of having a government without a king. And then the next one that's really well documented is Athens. And from about 600 to 300 B.C., a guy named Solon, S-O-L-O-N, had set up a democracy in Athens. And he leaves town, so they have to do it. And so everybody voted on everything. And they would meet in the market and talk politics. And if you didn't keep up with politics in the city of Athens, you were called an idiotus, an idiot. And then another interesting dynamic is if there's a king and you want to lobby the king, you go to his court and try to weasel your way into his presence and pitch your agenda. But if there is a democracy, how do you pitch an agenda to all the people? Well, theater. That's when the Greeks invented theater. And so from that time till now, theater, Hollywood, media has always been political. It's always pushing some point of view. And but I hear the music there. So
you do, and we'll be back in just a moment with William Fetter. But this is an excellent overview of how governments are created and how they fall. William, go right ahead.
So the title of my book is Change to Chains. It's the 6,000-year quest for global control. And how did Athens fall? Well, there was a guy named Plato, and he was a disciple of Socrates. And he witnessed the democracy in Athens and said it was chaos. Everybody having a say on everything and different groups, you know, aligning here and there. And he said that the city government would go through five stages. The first stage was aristocracy, people that knew how to run farms and businesses, knew how to run the city. They're just responsible. They just have a knack for making sure everything balances on the bottom of the page. And he says that these are called the rule of the capable, or he called them rule of an aristocracy. But these were followed by a second group he called timocracy, lovers of fame. These are people that don't know how to run anything. They just like being in front, getting the attention. And they just are famous. And so you go from people that know how to run businesses to somebody that maybe is a football star, or maybe a Hollywood actor, or maybe somebody that, you know, did something to become popular, but they don't know how to run stuff. And that is sort of what our politicians are. They're experts at one thing, getting elected. And, you know, you look at our current president. What did he run before he ran our country? You know, tell me the name of the business. Tell me the city, the state, the village, anything. He didn't run anything. He just learned how to become famous, how to structure it. Anyway, Plato said you go from the rule of the capable to rule of the famous. And then these famous people, since they don't know how to run stuff, the natural tendency is to vote themselves favors. And so it creates a clique, an in-clique, where if you're, you know, friends with these people, you get the favors. And so it's called an oligarchy, a rule by few. And they're these few people who are always voting themselves favors. They're writing into bills things that, you know, they repay their, bring pork back to their supporters. And well, the people finally overthrow this oligarchy, this rule of the few, the clique, and they set up a democracy. But all that they know how to do is vote themselves favors. That's what's been modeled for them by the oligarchy. And so the people vote themselves favors. They raid the treasury, take the money out, pass, spread the wealth around. And then when they run out of money, they go after the rich. And so they tax the rich more and more until there's no rich left, or any of the smart ones have left the country. And then finally there's not enough money and they have to cut back. And so they bicker amongst themselves and they begin to fight. And Plato says that democracy without virtue and self-control always ends in chaos, out of which a tyrant arises. So you got this bickering going on, and they're cutting back, and they're getting mad, and they say, well, somebody has to come along and fix this. And finally somebody comes along and says, I'll fix it. Just give me all of your cards. Give me all your rights. Give me all your power. I'll fix it. Yeah, martial law. And so this plan of Plato's is fivefold. You go from rule of the capable, to rule of the famous, to rule of a clique called an oligarchy, to a democracy, and democracy without virtue and self-control always ends in chaos, out of which a tyrant arises. Now, if you extrapolate and say, well, if you want to be the tyrant, then you want to cause a democracy to devolve into chaos. And so you have to get rid of any type of morality and internal restraints, and you want people to give into their passions and lusts, so there'll be a crisis. And so there will be the excuse that you can assume power from.
All right, hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. But basically, of course, democracy always results in despotism.
Right, right.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. This is me and William Federer, simply giving us the history of what happens in governments. And you start out usually with the aristocracy of rule by the capable, followed by rule by the famous, followed by rule, certainly, by the
oligarchy.
An oligarchy, followed by a democracy, followed by despotism. This is the stages that the governments go through. And Plato had said, democracy always results in despotism. It descends into despotism. And this is why they lie to us today. I was taught when I went to the University of California, America was a democracy. All the newspapers talk about democracy. All the politicians talk about democracy. Certainly all of the college professors talk about democracy. All the politicians talk about democracy. At the end of the study of the history of our nation, our founding fathers, recognizing what had happened down through the ages, created a republic. And the fact this is never taught in school today, it simply reflects the degree of control that exists today of what the American people think. And basically this is why, because they're doing everything they can to destroy the moral foundation of a society, to destroy the religious foundation of a society, to destroy the family and belief in God and belief in right and wrong. Everything is relative. There are people who want a dictatorship. And, of course, they want this final stage of government. And believe me, ladies and gentlemen, it's coming unless we have a spiritual revival in this country and people begin to understand that freedom is not free. You have to be involved. And you have to understand there really are people who want a dictatorship who are using the power of the media and education and the churches to destroy the moral fabric of our society. Go right ahead, William.
So Plato said the best you can hope for is a nice tyrant. He called him a philosopher king. And he said this philosopher king is the head of gold, and his military and administrative staff are the chest of silver, and then the people are the abdomen of bronze. And he said it's okay for the head of gold to teach a lie, because the lie will help him stay in power, and it's good for him to stay in power because he naturally knows how to run things. And Plato says that he will gather the children from their parents and bring them into the city, and he will indoctrinate them with his noble lie. And so every communist dictator has claimed to be the philosopher king, has claimed to be Plato's, you know, nice tyrant, that they just, you know, and they'll indoctrinate the kids and fill their brain full of lies because it'll help them stay in power. And so what happened to Athens? Athens had there was a king to the north named Philip of Macedon, and he was conquering different cities, and he finally got a hold of some gold mines, and Philip took the gold and bribed citizens in Athens to be traitors, to be propagandists, to lie. So they when they would all go to the marketplace and talk politics, these traitors would stand up and say, well, you know, Philip's not such a bad guy. I heard he's liberating these cities. He's not conquering them. And so these paid propagandists would gather around themselves people that Lenin later called useful idiots. These are people that believe the propaganda and lies. And they'd get out there with their, you know, Occupy Wall Street sign and say, you know, we don't know why we're here, but we're just, you know, being paid to be here. You know, we're just, and so it's so confused Athens that when Philip marched up to the gates, they just threw him open, and he came in and took over. And the people of Athens did not get a chance to rule themselves again for over 2,000 years. So after Philip came his son Alexander the Great, then after him came the Roman emperors, and after them came the Byzantine emperors, and after them came the Muslim sultans, and after them came World War One, and they got their freedom, but then they joined the EU, and they got so in debt that now the EU determines the Greece's fate. And so a people deciding their own government is a very, very rare occurrence in world history. It's like the dandelion sprouting through the pavement of totalitarianism. And anyway, and you had mentioned the difference between a democracy and a republic. Democracy is everybody votes on everything. And it only worked in Athens for those 200 years on a city level. And it could, and they said that it could not operate any on anything larger than a city. Because if you were going to have people voting and they didn't live in that city, they would be dependent on somebody to bring them the news. And so it got to the place of whoever controls the information controls the democracy. Because you can only vote on what you know about. You only know what the media tells you.
And that is exactly what's going on today. We'll be back here in just a moment with William Federer. Talk about his book, From Change to Chains. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Dr. Stan. I guess William Federer. William, go right ahead.
So Rome is an interesting story. I don't know if I've talked about it before, but there are some interesting things that bear repeating. Rome had a king who raped a girl named Lucretia, and the girl was so upset she committed suicide right in front of all the Roman leaders. And these Roman leaders decided to kill the king, and then they passed a law that if anybody ever declared themselves king in Rome, anybody could kill that person without any repercussions. So for 500 years, nobody in Rome ever wanted to come anywhere near being called the king. And one of the founders of the Roman Republic was Publius, and he was building a mansion on a hill, and rumor went that he may be thinking of being a king. He destroyed his own mansion before it was even completed. And so this was Rome. So Rome had a republic. A republic means res publica, in the place of. So where Athens, you have to keep up on everything, otherwise you're an idiotus. In Rome, you would have a representative that would look out for your interests while you spent your time supporting your family, you know, and working your farm or your business. And so these representatives, res publica, were in your place. Now, as it happens, the Roman Republic, these representatives ended up being hereditary to the paters, the fathers of the Republic, and they had about 600 senators. So they were not elected senators. We have about 600 in our country that rule our republic. You know, we have 435 congressmen, 100 senators, so that's 535. Then you had the president, his cabinet, and so forth. You get up close to 600, you know, with the Supreme Court and so forth. And many would say that ours are hereditary now because they passed the law so that they get to stay in pretty much. But nevertheless, Rome had about 600 senators, and as the years went by, these senators ended up being the wealthy ones, and the people ended up being in debt, and there was some discontent amongst the people, and there was somebody from one of these rich senator families that was bankrupt. His name was Julius Caesar, and he joined the military to escape debt collectors. Turns out he's a great general and conquers lots of Gaul, France, and he brings back booty into Rome and gives it to the people, right? So they, you know, bring all the captured stuff back and get divided up amongst the people. So the people like this Julius Caesar guy. He's giving away free stuff. Anyway, Caesar decides to run for Senate.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. My guest is William Federer. And so we're getting the rundown on what happened in Rome and how it was that Julius Caesar came to power. But before we do that and go any further, why, William, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get to your website, how they can get to your books. Go right ahead.
Well, my website is AmericanMinute.com, AmericanMinute.com, and I send out a free daily email, as you mentioned, the American Minute. So it's something that happened on each day in American history, and so it takes all this history and breaks it down into little bite-sized daily doses, and you know, people forward them to their friends and you know, read them on the radio or you know, read them to their homeschool class or whatever. It's just AmericanMinute.com.
Okay, fine. And then how can people get your book?
Either the website or AmericanMinute.com, or I have a toll-free telephone number, and that's 888-USA-WORD, 888-USA-WORD. And the title of the book is Change to Chains. A little play on words there. And but I've written about 20 books, and they all have to do with history, and I usually like to highlight what made America great. And that's what this one does. And, you know, if you have a spectrum of power, one side's total government, the other side's no government, right? One side is totalitarianism, ruled by a dictator king, and all power is concentrated into the hands of ultimately one person. But the other side of the spectrum is no government whatsoever, anarchy, right? Well, America was able to get closest to the anarchy side of the spectrum than any other previous country because we had a secret ingredient. Judeo-Christian morality. We could get by without a strong external government because the people were taught an internal government. They were taught we're all equal in the eyes of a creator who's looking down and watching us, and he wants us to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. We're supposed to treat people and forgive, and you, we shall be forgiven, and, you know, and all the, you know, whatever you do, at least he's my brother and you do unto me. And so the Christian gospel has made it so that, and of course the Jewish law, the reciprocity that the punishment fits the crime, you know, you don't, it's not like Islam where you steal something and get your hand cut off, you know, I mean, there's equal justice. And so, the Judeo-Christian faith made it so that America could get by without a king and still keep order. You know, when the, rug is pulled out from these dictators in the Middle East, you know, the Shah of Iran, you know, Obama calls the president of Egypt Mubarak and tells him it's time to step down, you know. And so one by one, these dictators get taken out, and they introduce quote-unquote democracy into these former Muslim countries, or these former dictatorships in these Muslim countries. How come whenever you introduce representative government or democracy into a Muslim country, it always ends up with the Black Panther Muslim Brotherhood taken over, and they institute Sharia law, and it's the death penalty to leave Islam. It's, and women and Jews and Christians are made into second-class citizens. How come those people don't experience the same freedoms and opportunities and liberties that America's founders did? That's because they have Islam underlying their experiment of the people ruling themselves, and Islam has no concept of equality. You know, an infidel cannot even testify in court against a Muslim. That Allah loves the Muslim who has submitted, and Allah hates the infidel who refuses to submit. There's no concept that you're all equal in the eyes of a creator. And then you look at the USSR, the Soviet Union, and the Berlin Wall comes down, and, you know, we helped them have republics and democratic forms of government, and 20 years has gone by. Who now controls these former Soviet states? Well, the black market, the mafia, the organized crime, 50% of their GDP is the black market. How come they didn't experience the same burst of freedom and opportunity and liberty and equality, equal justice before the law that America's founders did? That's because they had 70 years of atheism underlying their experiment of the people ruling themselves. In America, we could get by, we could get rid of our king and still keep order because we had these internal morals, that you're equal in the eyes of a creator and doing others as you'd have them do it to you. So something really unique happened in America. And when you do as I did, you examine all of the other civilizations that existed on the planet. We got it. We had all the right ingredients came together. And, anyway, in the book, I continue to go through, you know, people say, well, how did Rome fall? And, well, Caesar. So here's Julius Caesar. He's the successful general. He decides to run for Senate, and he gets into the Roman Senate. He makes a triumvirate, sort of a super congress secret agreement with a rich Republican named Pompey. Pompey was this old Republican establishment guy who just wanted to maintain the status quo and keep the order the way it is, you know. And then there's a rich, rich guy who's named Crassus. He's sort of like the George Soros of the day. And he helps to underwrite Julius Caesar. And, well, Crassus dies. And now it's a political tug-of-war between Julius Caesar and Pompey. But Caesar doesn't have any money. And so what does he do? He robs the federal treasury. It was the Temple of Saturn. That's where the Roman gold, the people's money, was stored up for 400 years. And it's got, you know, tens of thousands of bars of silver and gold and 50 million sesterces, which was their Roman coin. And so Caesar takes the money from the federal treasury and uses it to buy supporters against Pompey. He said, use money to get men, use men to get money. This is like raiding the federal treasury and taking stimulus money and giving it out to Acorn and SEIU and union contracts and government, you know, employees. And this is buying votes. And Will and Ariel Durant, in their Lessons of History, they said 53 B.C., that's when Caesar was there, that one group of voters was paid 50 million sesterces for their support. And so that's what Caesar did. He bought he bought votes with money to buy supporters against Pompey. So he finally gets rid of Pompey, and he's dead. And so what does Caesar do? Does he give the power to the people? No, he makes himself dictator for life. And he starts the cult of Julius Caesar with Mark Antony as his high priest. And so if you didn't like 600 senators deciding your fate, now you've got one. And so where Caesar was saying, okay, everybody, I'm for you against these terrible, rich, you know, senators, he just duped them because he just used their support to make himself a dictator. And, of course, he was so powerful, he changed the calendars. And March 1st was the beginning of the year, and February was the end of the year. And so he decides to name a month after himself, July. And then he it only had 30 days, so he took a day from the end of the year, which was February, and he added it to July. And so that's why July has 31, and February had the one less. But then the next Caesar was Augustus. So he named a month after himself, August. And it only had 30 days, so he took a day from the end of the year, February, added it to August. That's why February is 28. And anyway, I could go on, but it's this total power that these guys had. And you know, then Rome fell, and I tell the story of how that happened in the book. But there's other experiments that were rare. There was Italian city-states. There was an Icelandic commonwealth for about 200 years where they had different tribes and judges, but no king. There was a city in Russia called Novgorod, where they would all meet together in the town square and shout. Whoever got the loudest shout was the leader, you know, for that period. And until Ivan IV of Moscow conquered Novgorod and killed about 30,000 people. And so their experiment of having a republic ended. And so all these attempts end. There's another one was the Dutch, the Seven United Netherlands. They were a merchant military empire that was a republic, and they had settlements in New Amsterdam, which became New York, and Aruba and Dutch Guyana, and they took over South Africa, and they had Goa, a city in India that they took from the Portuguese. They had Dutch Indonesia, and they had an island off the coast of Japan that they had a monopoly on trade with Japan for 200 years. And so this Dutch world empire had a unique way of raising money for all this without taxes. It was called the Amsterdam Stock Exchange. So if you wanted to invest in a boat going to Japan, and when it came back, you'd partake in the profits. So people would pitch in their own money. You wouldn't have to tax. And what if the ship sank? Well, then the Dutch invented insurance companies. And of course, they settled New Amsterdam, and they had a New Amsterdam Stock Exchange. It met along the edge of town where they had a wall. And when the British took it over, they changed it from New Amsterdam to New York. It was the New York Stock Exchange that met on Wall Street. And so our Wall Street is a remnant of the Dutch Republic of how to raise money without taxes. And so I go through these attempts to have governments without a king. What happened to the Dutch? Well, they got into a war with Britain, and then eventually Napoleon conquered them, and they lost their role of leadership in the world. And but America, when America was formed, there was really not another functioning republic in the world. You know, the end of the Dutch Republic, maybe an Italian city-state, a Swiss canton or something, but nobody that had a global impact. So America was really unique on the world scene. And our founders hated monarchy. They hated the fact that King George III was the king of their country, the commander of their military, and the head of their church. And so our founders took the power of a king and separated it into three branches. They separated federal to state level, and then they tied up this new federal Frankenstein with 10 handcuffs we call the First Ten Amendments. So our Constitution is basically a bunch of hurdles to slow down power from reconcentrating into the hands of a dictator. You know, they made it intentionally slow for change. And so, you know, we have to go back and forth from the House to the Senate and, you know, go to these committees. And our founders, change was bad. So they designed a government that was intentionally slow to change on purpose, slow to making good decisions, but thank God it was slow to making bad decisions. They understood it could take a lifetime to build a mansion, and one irresponsible match to burn the thing down in a day. And so the last thing they wanted was to have some people say, well, we got to pass this bill so we can find out what's in it. We got this deadline. We got to hurry up and pass this thing by some arbitrary deadline that the president set up. Nonsense. They would have never done that. They wanted to be very, very slow to make sure that's exactly what the intent of the people was. But, and so when you look at world history, you see, and I speak in schools, I'll have the kids hold up a fist in one hand and say concentrated power, and then an open palm with their fingers apart with the other hand and say separated power, then they go back to the fist. I said, that's world history. You go from concentrated powers of the Caesars, Pharaohs, Kaisers, Sultans, and Tsars. Every now and then the rubber band gets stretched and people separate the power, but it always snaps back in times of crises. And so in America, it snapped back unintentionally through history as well as intentionally. And so we look at some of the snapping back. The most notable is the Civil War. You know, Washington's farewell address, he says, usurpation, though in one instance may be the instrument of good, it is the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed. Usurpation. That's doing something you're not supposed to, and you get away with it long enough, everybody assumes that's the new rules. And so, usurpation. It's an instrument of good. So here's Lincoln. It was good that he ended slavery, but in the process, a lot of rights went from the states to the federal government. Woodrow Wilson, it was good that he got us through World War I, but in the process, he concentrates power with the Federal Reserve and the income tax. And FDR, he intended good, you know, with his New Deal programs, but he concentrated power in the federal government with all these, you know, government work programs. Then there's Lyndon Johnson. You know, he intended good to get rid of poverty, but he concentrated power with his welfare state, Great Society programs, you know. And then Nixon's war on drugs concentrates power in the federal government. Bush's war on terror concentrates power in the federal government so they can read your emails and track your credit card purchases. But now there's all these crises, and the president, the current president says, oh, I got to do this good. I've got to usurp power. I got to take rights away from the people in the states. You know, we got this crisis. We got a health care crisis. We got a debt crisis. I got to usurp power. So, in, you know, Washington warns, he says, usurpation, though in one instance may be the instrument of good, it's the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed. So, in times of crises, power concentrates. So, if you wanted to be that dictator, you could intentionally create the crises. So rather than it just being coincidental, it could have a plan behind it. And so that's when Rahm Emanuel, who said never let a good crisis go to waste, you know, raises some red flags. That's why David Axelrod, who said in Chicago politics we have a tradition where you create a crisis, you throw a brick through your own campaign office window, and then call a press conference to accuse your opponent. And so this idea of tanking the economy on purpose, raising the price of oil on purpose, having people hurt financially on purpose, because the more people you can get dependent on the government handouts, they're going to vote for the candidate that continues those handouts. And, you know, it's a basic motive of human nature. Nobody will vote to stop getting free money. You know, at the time our country was founded, most people were business owners, shopkeepers, and they wanted to keep the government small because they didn't want the government taxing and taking away their money. But once you get the majority of the people getting money from the government, getting handouts and welfare and food stamps and Social Security checks and government jobs and union contracts, they're all now pulling the teeter-totter in the direction of, we want the government to get bigger because we want to continue getting these free benefits.
And, of course, what they want, of course, is for the government to tax the rich people but not them. And so we've got almost 49% of the people in America today who don't pay any income tax, but they're quite willing to vote for the politicians who will tax the rich. The only trouble is when you tax the rich, very often you get in less money because the rich will figure a means around it. Recently, they elevated the taxes in Great Britain to over 50% on the wealthy. The amount of money that the federal government was getting from taxes fell. The federal government in England today then has to find other means of income. They begin to sell off their roads. other public facilities so that they can have toll roads, but they have to get money. And everything they do is they increase the amount of money the government takes in, and they end up with less and less money. And, of course, then, of course, they begin to restrict freedom more, and now it'll cost people to drive on the roads. And the whole economy is beginning to contract in England simply because they're a socialist state, and they've run out of money. Go right ahead.
And then they have to let in immigrants because they said, we don't have money, let's bring in immigrants, let them work and pay taxes. Well, guess what? 70% of immigrants into Europe are Muslim, and now they're seeing themselves Islamified. But it is a important understanding that when you power, the power of tax is the power to destroy. That was what 4th Supreme Court Justice John Marshall said. So taxing is destroying. It's chasing away whatever it is that you're taxing.
Hold that thought. William, we've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
So I've identified 5 reasons why businesses leave the country. One is higher taxes over here than there, more lawsuits over here than over there, higher union wages here than over there, more environmental restrictions here than over there, and more government bureaucracy and red tape and forms to fill out here than over there. And so you do that long enough and businesses leave. And then we're left trying to keep this great country going with, you know, no businesses and money. So the Democrat agenda is that. But Pharaoh in Egypt, the story of 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine. What happened that first year of famine in Egypt? People said, we don't have food. Government, take our cattle, give us food. Second year, take our land, give us food. Finally, take us and our kids and our posterity, just give us a handout. And all the power in Egypt was concentrated into the hands of one person, the Pharaoh. So if your goal is to be the Pharaoh, and you could intentionally create the famine and put people out of work, they'll sell their souls to continue to keep getting their welfare checks and food stamps and so forth. And so we see this agenda that's being put in place, this re-election strategy, is to want to have people hurting and want to have them out of work so that they'll be able to, the president can give one of his really eloquent speeches and blame the Republicans and can motivate them, the people, to support him for re-election. But there's a whole lot more, but it's in the book, Change to Chains. It's the 6,000-year quest for control. And AmericanMinute.com is my website.
All right. Well, I guess it's been William Federer. It's a great book. We do carry it. We think it's a very important book. And we certainly appreciate everything you do with him to help us. I appreciate you coming on tonight on short notice. But I think it's so important that people have a grasp of history. There's nothing new under the sun. All of the things we're seeing today have happened before. And, of course, when you increase taxes, people tend to move away. Increase the bureaucracy, people tend to move away. And so they do everything you can to centralize more power with the government. Why, of course, businesses tend to leave and go elsewhere where they're going to be more accepted. And the unions, of course, drive up wages, and we set up a vicious cycle. And that's what we're seeing today. What's the solution?
Repent. I believe that you know, the physical is a reflection of the spiritual, that we're spiritually in debt, you know, and we're you know, the book Israel, whenever they turned from God, he let them economically and physically get overrun, and they would repent, and he'd bless them again. And so anyway, it's another book that I wrote called Prayers and Presidents, but we need to get serious about returning to the values.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess William Federer and Grace's plea is what we need to do is return to God. If this nation does not return to God, we're going to lose this nation. There's nothing new about what's going on here. They're doing everything wrong as far as trying to solve our problems. They're building up the unions to make it more difficult for business. They're increasing the amount of bureaucratic regulations. Certainly, we're increasing the taxes on businesses. And all of these things are simply driving businesses away. Eventually, of course, the whole economic system breaks down. And when I asked William what we should do, he said, repent. And if this nation doesn't turn back to God, then, of course, God is going to bring his judgment on this nation. Good night, William. Thank you so very much for being with us. Fascinating, fascinating book, if we do carry it, we recommend it strongly. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, that was just William Federer. His book is From Chains to Change. From Chains, C-H-A-I-N-S, to Change. Or should, I should say From Change, C-H-A-N-G-E, to Change, C-H-A-I-N-S. The book is available by calling 1-800-544-8927. But you can't understand what's going on today unless you understand what's happened in the past. Increasing taxes only tends to drive successful people out of the country. Suddenly strengthen the unions tends to raise union wages and make it suddenly unappealing to business. Suddenly increasing the bureaucracy drives people away. And there's nothing new about what's going on today. We're doing everything we can to force businesses out of this country. They know what they're doing. The jobs are not coming back. America's on a downward spiral to destruction. And, of course, the only thing we can do is get back to our concepts of a republic and get back to the worship of God, because I believe, of course, there's powerful spiritual forces that want to destroy America, that want to impoverish our people, that want to establish a dictatorship. That's why you need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, here, my talk on the dark secret and on the forbidden secret, the two separate talks. And then, of course, we have syllabuses to go with them. You certainly would want to get our latest DVD. It's called The Dangerous Deception. The Dangerous Deception is an interview I did 30 years ago with Norman Dodd, who is the director of research for the Reese Committee, the only congressional committee ever allowed to investigate the great tax-exempt foundations and the Council on Foreign Relations. And they found out, of course, they were pushing subversion. Their goal, of course, was to change America and to so alter life here that it would altered forever. And, of course, to destroy the love which everyone should have for America. You'll want to hear that interview with Norman Dodd, and then you'll want to hear my critique. And, of course, we do give you a critique that brings you up to date. That's The Dangerous Deception, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And our webpage is radioliberty.com. You certainly go to our webpage. You can watch our television programs, our DVDs. You can listen to our radio programs. You can read our newsletters. The information is there. We hope you'll get other people to watch and to listen and to begin to understand. We also have another new DVD. It's by Ross and Peterson. It's called Geoengineering, and it goes in the background of aerial spraying, chemtrails, contrails, suddenly the efforts to geoengineer our atmosphere and the disastrous results. Because, ladies and gentlemen, they are poisoning our water, they are poisoning our air, they are poisoning our food, and they know exactly what they're doing. They don't want you to know. You'll be fascinated when you hear Rosalind's presentation and the presentation of the gentleman who was with her, who spent some 30 years working for the government in weather modification. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Please pray for America, but pray for Radio Liberty, our provision and our protection.
Let us all be grateful.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Power Hour Radio Show. Thank you for joining us today. Caring about your world, doing the next right thing. It is the 26th of March. It is Monday. End of the month. Last week in the month. So glad to have you joining us today. I will be with you live only in the first 5 minutes. Then we're going to bring on replays, the best of the programs that Maria has carefully scheduled for you to have this week. I'm going to be taking the time off with this foreclosure issue that I'm dealing with. It's going to require a lot of time, and we don't have much of that, given the fact that we have a date of which this information has to be responded to. Now, you all know the foreclosure, if you've been listening to the program, that we are experiencing here, has been paid off on a house over 3 years ago. That's right. It is a fraud. It is